Hi everyone, Ruben Di Norena here. I'm really excited today to start this new podcast where I'll be interviewing people with interesting career journeys and stories to share. And we'll hopefully inspire some young people to see things from a slightly different perspective and also think big. My guest today is Craig Fenton. Craig is the Director of Strategy and Operations at Google for the UK, Ireland, and many other countries. And also the author of the book, Playful Curiosity, a manifesto for reinventing education. Craig, thanks for agreeing to make this happen.
My pleasure.
So you've had a really successful career, and with that comes exposure to different people, different ways of thinking, different cultures. So I was wondering if you could take us back to your time at university where you were studying law. First of all, what made you choose law, and what advice do you have for young people who are either going to decide what subjects to study at university or college or doing an apprenticeship? Because it can be really confusing. There's so many options nowadays.
So,
what advice do you have for them, and also how was your experience like?
Well, I'm asking a question, of course, to describe my process. In the first piece of advice I've given is don't do that. When I was a graduate at university, I studied in Auckland, in New Zealand.
Yeah.
I'm Kiwi originally, although I've been in the UK for 22 years. And it was fairly normal to progress out of school and go on to university in those days. And there are a relatively limited set of professions that you can pass into.
Yeah.
I did two degrees, actually. He had some really interesting study opinions on what made sense.
Yeah.
And if it was good enough for Mike, it was good enough for me. And it also saved me the immense job of reading what looked like a very thick Bible or phone book at the time of all of the millions of courses that were available. I also felt like that was sort of setting me up as a good foundation sort of thing. And actually, after that, I went into law, I was a
corporal in the garrison,
you call it.
So were you wearing
like a... I had to work in the
wow.
Little bands and the black
cloak. Yeah.
And spent my time doing mostly civil litigation, so commercial and negligence, public law type stuff, in court. Learned some great skills, you know, absorbing fixed ways of information, structuring an argument in a logical way, and then assembling that information to persuade the judge or the person of the outcome. It was a great formative time for me and taught me a lot. The advice I have to people perhaps in a similar situation today, considering what to do, is very simple. It's think about what you love, like what really excites you, and do that. And do that wherever that takes you, whether it's an apprenticeship, straight into the business world, starting your own company, which I know you've done, Ruben, or going to university. There are many, many different options, many more than I have the choice of. But the North Star should be your why, not your want.
Yeah. What do you mean by that? Choose your why and not your what?
So people often ask the question, what do you want to do?
Yeah.
Which leads you immediately into a discussion about a role, company, function.
Exactly.
And actually, none of those things are anything more than a vehicle for expressing yourself or doing something that you enjoy. Your why is actually several layers deep, it's usually more stable more limited than the number of options that you can express that in. So there are many what's that can make a why.
Yeah.
And the best way of describing it is, you know, what is the thing, if you think of your sort of life experience, your personal experience, your passions, that really excites you, your eyes light up, you start talking a bit faster.
Yeah.
it brings a smile to your face. These are all symptoms that you're indulging in something that you're very passionate about, whether that be music, maths, sports, or business relations. And there are many other things as well.
So what's your why?
My why, I love to build things or change things.
Yeah.
So that's more of a happiness in the process of that. I grew up in a pretty isolated country at the bottom of the world, pre-internet.
So
I'm absolutely fascinated and ignited by the way that technology enables pretty much anyone the access and opportunity to do stuff, whether it's build a micro multinational business or become a creator.
So you mentioned that you spent a couple of years as a barrister, practicing as a barrister. So what led you to transition from or pivot into consulting later on? Because I imagine after investing so many years practicing as a barrister, most people would just want to continue in that line because they feel comfortable in that environment. So what led you to want to pivot into consulting?
I was six years. Good period of time. I found the equipment that intellectually assimilated. They taught me and the teachers detail. As I said earlier, an ability to structure an argument, to present it in a persuasive way. The confidence to talk publicly, which is what advocacy is. And also the ability to be in service of others. In a way, clients and customers and so on. I found that very intellectually stimulating. I didn't find it so creatively challenging. So once you become experts in the field, it becomes a little bit automatic. Uncomfortably comfortable, if that makes sense. And we like to be comfortably uncomfortable. I also was at the dawn of the internet, where I'm talking late 90s. So, dot-com bubble, as it was born, was starting to inflate. There were mad companies launching to change the world, getting mad valuations. We didn't quite know how to get our heads around this, and I found that absolutely fascinating and magnetic. So I wanted to try my hand in a bigger sea, so to speak, on a different stage in the technology field, and I knew I had a strong interest in business. I just didn't know how to get there. Probably I need to take some time out, figure that out. I'm also in the process of that with brands. So I applied to a few business schools. I went to London Business School in the MBA. That's quite my rebranding, my coming out party. Leaving the law and entering the next phase of my life. And it was a good pivot.
I was going to ask, what would you say that the MBA helped you, and was it worth it?
Yes is the short answer. For me, yes, it did help. But I feel I needed to refresh my skills. And this is a lifelong journey. And it was an effective way of rebranding and getting me in the door. That probably wouldn't have happened and consulting too, and it's a great way of having to know. And yeah, I was interested in this, absolutely, you know, what type of business, what type of role, but really naive still.
So consulting allowed you to really explore.
Consulting was a sort of a, you know, it's a great exercise in business tourism.
Yeah.
In the sense that you get to work with many different companies, yeah, and many different problems, and many different, as it turned out in my case, many different countries,
yeah,
and economic contexts. And that really opens your eyes to the realities of what business leaders face,
yeah,
as they try and navigate and grow or handle competition and the ebbs and flows of doing business. So it's a, yeah, great way to really learn on an extended basis.
So you spent 16 years at Accenture, and number one is, what kept you there so long? Because 16 years is a really, really long time. And over those 16 years, you worked across how many different countries?
My final job that I had at Accenture was after 124 countries.
Wow.
In terms of working while you were properly working in countries, it was probably 20.
Yeah.
I did a long period in the UK, I had 2 years in Germany, I worked in Italy, Greece, Central Europe, I had a stint in Russia, I worked in Turkey, I had a stint in Saudi Arabia and the UAE, I worked in Spain, I did some time in the Nordics, France and Denmark. And this wasn't just sort of helicoptering in for the odd meeting, it was,
yeah,
like an extended period,
yeah,
of getting myself ingrained in the culture of that place, working in companies, building relationships,
yeah,
all the time living in London. So I was a very good customer of BA, mostly BA at the time. But it's a really good time. 16 years does seem like a long time.
Yeah.
But I set a rule for myself really early on that I would spend no longer than 2 or 3 years in a single job in the United Kingdom.
Yeah, yeah.
And I did that on site. So over 16 years, I think I had 8 roles.
8 roles.
And they were very, very different. There was a common thread there, but they were different countries, different companies, different contexts. And consulting is one of those places where that can come with some variety. My initial plan, however, was to go into consulting and do this sort of business tourism. And 2 years going to get a proper job.
Oh, okay.
And what I found is that the company started changing their feet in,
yeah,
a way that was, I felt, exciting and interesting and really sustainable.
Yeah.
So I had a very positive experience with Accenture. It taught me a lot.
Yeah.
I had many people I call mentors and friends who,
yeah,
are still there or have subsequently left like I have. Really good words to say about the company, but eventually I felt the learning curve started to flatten out and I was able to do some things.
I see. So during your time at Accenture, when you were leading all these complex sales functions, and building also other leaders within the team, I wanted to ask you about how you measured success, because I assume in a sales environment, a lot of people would think that you get a certain number that you have to hit, and then how do you as a leader encourage people to be, number one, be motivated to do well and to hit targets, but also not get too caught up with the number, because sometimes I think that can do more harm than good.
I agree, yeah. I totally agree. First of all, measuring success in sales is pretty easy. It is a number.
Yeah.
And it's a sustainable number that hopefully grows over time. So it's a pretty simple game to measure, but it's a much more complex thing to execute.
Yeah.
And the one thing I learned after a very long period in sales, this is a major thing, I should say, is that the best way to sell is not to, it's to listen.
Yeah.
To really genuinely, authentically put yourself in the shoes of the person to try to help. See the world through their eyes.
Yeah.
And do everything in your power to make them and their company and their cause a success.
Yeah.
And that sometimes requires you to take decisions in the short term that are harmful to your own business. But if you're there to solve, you know, this is a long term play,
yeah,
trust based relationships, and it's a long term game, and you need to be authentically there in a partnership in the long term, not be for the short term transaction. That's particularly important. in consulting. And the other thing that's true of sales is that it's a team game. You know, like football or netball or whatever sport, it's a team game. So you're only as good as the team dynamic that you have.
Yeah.
There's very little room for hero runs for the line.
Yeah.
Individual performances that may be brilliant, but I don't use the full force of the team around you. So one of the delightful things that I had in that period was the joy of working with people. You get to know them so well, you kind of communicate without speaking, you know exactly what plays on the field they play.
Yeah.
And it all happens as they like magic, like watching Barcelona.
Yeah. So in your book Play for Curiosity, you talk a bit about how there was research that Google did into high performing teams, and it found that the teams that performed the best were the teams that felt psychologically safe. So can you talk a bit about that research and how important it is to build teams that are that feels safe to be in that environment and not afraid to raise their hand when they make a mistake or need extra training?
Yeah, absolutely. So, first of all, Play for Curiosity is a book about education.
Yeah.
It's a commentary and intentional provocation that's intended to start dialogue about the suitability of our current system.
What prompted you to write that, by the way?
Well, I'm probably 2 teenage boys, 1-17, 1-14, so I'm a customer of the system in a sense, and believe that it is. I'm also a leader in the open tech company.
Yeah.
I see the talent coming through the door, and I see what works and what doesn't work, and the skill sets that need to survive and thrive in an environment where innovation is existentially important. And as I reflected on, I also believe that there is some amazing, like teaching is one of the most noble professions. It really is.
Yeah.
There's very few jobs that are more important than that. Yeah. And there are some wonderful, wonderful teachers and kids in this country who do incredible things.
Yeah, I think they're underrated.
Absolutely underrated, underpaid.
Yeah.
And they do so with a system that constrains them. And my country is about the system.
Yeah.
And I believe in a world, I'll come back to your question in a moment, which helps to answer it. In a world where change is constant, you know, the reality is we, no matter what age and stage you are, and certainly our children, are being prepared for jobs that don't exist, for companies that haven't been founded using technology that hasn't been invented.
Yeah.
So change is a concept, and what separates the good from the great in that context is the ability to be very comfortable with the ambiguity, to be agile, adaptable, to see around corners, to imagine a future that's different, and then go create it, and to be creative in a very vulnerable way, you know, harness that imagination and nature that you all have. And apply it in valuable directions, because we live in a wonderful, wonderful age where that simply is possible, largely enabled by technology.
Yeah.
And in order to do that, you need to create, first of all, a mindset of curiosity. No one knows the answer. And
yeah.
The answer that might be true today probably isn't next month. So you need to be led through this curiosity, this fascination with finding out and asking these questions. Second, we need to be comfortable with experimentation. And to be comfortable with experimentation, we need to be comfortable with failure.
Yeah.
Actually, failure is the necessary part of the experimentation process that leads
exactly. You
to insights and learning. And to be comfortable with that, you need to be psychologically safe. You need to be okay with taking risks and know that people around you have your back. Expect it and congratulate you for it rather than chastise you for it. And you need to learn through experience, right? Not
yeah.
just through theory. Yeah. But theory is what other people found out. Experience is what really stays with you.
Yeah.
Because you sort of touch it, feel it, smell it, experience it. And if we then, because so that's what good looks like, if you then compare that to our system, our education system, not only in this country, but in pretty much every other country, with a few exceptions, Finland, for example, like we regurgitate and disseminate desiccated facts, these building blocks that others are actually following. Now, to a certain extent, that's necessary. You need a few building blocks to know how to sort of thing. But beyond that, it becomes a bit wasteful. We examine and test a very narrow band of intelligence, right? So we go to the rewards or nurture tactile intelligence, physical intelligence, artistic intelligence, all of these other intelligences.
Yeah.
So we test a very narrow band of intelligence, and we do it through a results-obsessed examination system where memory, recall, and exam technique are rewarded and rigorous punished.
So if you
sort of think about the world today and sat down with a black sheet of paper and tried to design a system that was more poorly suited than the one that we have, you'd be hard-pressed. And frankly, the system really hasn't changed since about the time that most Victorian houses in London were
100 years.
It was designed at a stage where post-industrial revolution, where what industry needed was a sort of minimum baseline level of competency, literacy, and numeracy, so that factory workers could operate these big factories.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's not needed anymore. The world's moved on. Yeah. Our education system somehow hasn't. Instead of nurturing and encouraging creativity, this application of imagination in both ways, we kind of almost beat it out of our children.
Yeah.
And it becomes this sort of curious co-collective activity that sits in the dark of the corner of the time.
Yeah. You're right, because I remember when I was studying at when I was doing my GCSEs actually, the people that used to get the highest grades were the ones that you typically could were really good at memorizing things. They had a gift for that, but I didn't have that, so it was really difficult for me because for the things that I was really, I found that for things that you're really curious about and passionate about, you tend to do well. And like I wasn't a big fan of reading textbooks, for example. I couldn't really do that. But for subjects that I was really interested in, I could.
Yeah.
And it goes to show that if you look at the things that you're really passionate about and try and explore and not being afraid to fail, as you said, I think that's so powerful because it can lead you to so many other things.
Well, your story is wonderful, isn't it? You sort of develop a very little interest in technology and you start building apps.
Yeah.
Why did you do that?
Yeah, because I was interested in it, and I was really passionate about creating things that because in school you have to follow this whole curriculum. Yeah. There's so many subjects, and for me there were only a handful that were really interesting, but all the others were you just had to do it because
that's how
to
do that.
Just. It's self-education, I think, and that's what I want to ask you about a bit more.
Experimentation.
Yeah, and failing. And YouTube was a key player in that because nowadays you can literally learn anything you want just by typing in. On YouTube, there's so many videos now, and there's a company that recently launched called MasterClass. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've seen it, but I did a class by Bob Iger, the CEO of Walt Disney Company, and it's just incredible that we live in this time where you can literally sit in your bedroom and learn business strategy, leadership from the CEO of the Walt Disney Company. It's amazing. No, you have to be. This is the question-based model. But there's a lot of stuff there.
There's a great story of a Kenyan called Julius Yeager.
Yeah.
He grew up in Kenya, and Kenya, of course, from a sporting point of view, is known for its long-distance flight.
Yeah.
And Julius was a gentleman flight. Do you think there was anyone available in Kenya to help train him, teach him, coach him? Definitely not.
Yeah.
And 30 years ago down to the dusty internet cafe down the road.
Yeah.
And watch YouTube videos. Wow. And he became known as Mr. YouTube. And Julius ended up winning the medal in the Rio Olympics.
Wow, that's incredible.
Wow. You know, so it's absolutely amazing. Anyway, your story and the story of so many others is about pursuing a passion, finding out by sort of tinkering and making mistakes and figuring it out through this experimentation process. And you can't do that if somebody's judging you or punishing you for it. So back to your question, psychological safety is an absolutely critical part of this. And this is what we found with Google. What's the key thing that separates great teams from good ones? It's the psychological safety. In other words, the risk tolerance of the team to take bets on things. And know that the people around them are going to hug them, support them, pick them up, celebrate their failures, figure out the learnings from them, and then move on. Just as you did when you were learning how to do that.
Yeah, exactly. So, in your book, there was a few things that kind of struck me. So I just want to make sure I'm getting this right. So you said knowledge is a, and you spoke a bit about this, but knowledge is a commodity and much of it is perishable. Knowledge is a commodity and much of it is perishable, quickly becoming obsolete. And then you also talked about how 65% of kids in primary school today will do jobs that do not currently exist. So my question for you is, what's the solution to that? Like, what can they do? I personally think that self-education is like the new norm now, because there's really no excuses now, because you can, the example I was talking about before about learning through YouTube, through other platforms, you can learn anything you want. And what do you think about that? Do you think that's because gone are the days where you can just go to university once and then that's it, and you're set for life, right?
Well, I think all of us are on, living in a time where learning is a lifelong cycle.
It
exists on a daily basis, on an hourly basis, on an annual basis. And what a fascinating and wonderful time. In my grandparents' days, they had jobs for life. So what a wonderful privilege and time that you live in. Not just perishable, what do I mean by that? Now, I don't want to sort of completely dismiss knowledge, right? Knowing what sort of chemical properties are in certain sorts of biological processes and how it forms sentence, so it's coherent and the people can understand how to solve an equation if you've got some unknown variables. These are knowledge blocks that are important, so I don't say they might not need to be taught, but we need to see them for what they are. They are building blocks that give you the foundation on which learning then happens. They're not the definition of learning, it just gives you a foundation, the systems level, and the skills and tools to then learn on top of that. I think the type of knowledge that's perishable, like my son, for example, is doing business studies. In his English. And what an interesting thing, right? So they're studying companies, great companies like Tesco and EasyJet.
Do they encourage them to actually start this?
Well, great question. I find absolutely ridiculous. No, encourage them to start. Actually, if you're studying business, why would you study business as opposed to building? An example of knowledge that's perishable is what happens to work today in, let's say, a grocery and supermarket is perishable. Because that probably won't be true, it's not in the same form, even in 6 months from now. What's more important is the curiosity of continuing to examine that and ask questions as you go along, as the system remains dynamic and continues to change. You know, Richard Feynman, great physicist, responsible for many breakthrough principles in thermodynamics and different things, wrote this book called The Joy of Finding Things Out. It's a wonderful book. I wish I knew Richard Feynman. You know, he was a Nobel Prize winner, lived in Brazil for a while, but he had this amazing ability to be creative in his field, actually. And it was his curiosity that drove him. And I think it's that fuel that all of us need to speak to God in the changing environments. And it's, it may be scary, but it's also absolutely exhilarating in the pursuit of these moments.
Yeah, so we talked a bit about your book, and where can people get your book, by the way?
Amazon.
So I want to talk to you about the transition between Accenture and Google. How did that happen, and what led you to transition to Google?
So I had a great career, as I said earlier.
Yes.
Accenture. I know many people call mentors and certain many of good friends. After a period, I felt I knew the environment pretty well. I'd done an awful lot of business tourism. And I felt that my learning curve started to gather. Actually, paradoxically, Accenture offered me a new role, which is the global role. Fantastically exciting.
Wow.
I had my choice of all roles at the time. Good at that.
Wow.
I felt very fortunate and lucky. Rather than sort of running towards it, I took a step back and asked myself my why question. That's it. But then I feel passionate about this. I felt that I was a little bit comfortable and sort of knew pretty much how to do my job, sort of how to have confidence that I wasn't learning as much as I should.
So you were really comfortable with it?
I was super comfortable with this. And you know, we've all got our weaknesses and strengths, and I said, you know, my fair share. When I like being uncomfortable in the sense of not knowing the answer and being really out of my depth, I love the experience of bumping into corners and falling over things and making mistakes. I find it exhilarating and tight in life. And I also felt that. I asked our jobs a very deep student in technology, and I could see, you know, some very big trends in the technology scene that I felt were of historical importance. So historians, 10, 20 years from now, will look back on the time that we're living in now as a very sharp inflection point.
Yeah.
It feels a bit like a sort of frogs in a pot that's slowly warming up and feel gradual, rather than sort of shocking and visceral about. It is shocking in history, in the scheme of history. And I wanted to find a way of putting myself in the middle of that. And I felt strongly that, as I said earlier, that technology is a great marketplace, and I thought I wanted to make an impact in some way. So I wrote a short list of other places that might serve those interests. I think I had three companies on the list. Google was one of them, and they, you know, right to Matt Britton, who runs Google in Europe, and pretty much said that, Matt, this is me, and this is what I feel is important and going on in the world. I'd love to have a chat. And as many things are in this life, the combination of luck, timing, and a few skills that are going to be into the job that I'm in.
Wow. So, so let's talk a bit about recruitment. So you've probably seen a lot of CVs during your time here and at Accenture. So what are the character traits that you look for in a successful candidate? And what's the best way to stand out? Because there's so much competition out there.
I think the best way to stand out is to talk about who you are rather than what you've done. Right, being very little of interest, you
very. That's interesting, actually.
I would glance through something about a CV as a courtesy if I were meeting somebody in an interview. But my eyes are immediately drawn to the section that generally sits at the bottom, but I think should be at the top, which is what that person's done outside of work and education.
Outside of work, yeah.
Right.
Why is that important though?
Because it tells you something about the character of the person, their ability to contribute to an environment change and their resilience. And it tells you something about whether that's a person that you want sitting in the seat beside you in the tough times. Much more than which university or other tertiary education institution they went to. You can't teach life in the university.
Yeah.
You know, so you're at a university now, so you have a fabulous education at the University of West Montreal.
Yeah.
I find your earlier story about how you taught yourself how to build apps
more important.
Much more interesting and important to helping me understand you. What you happen to be doing now.
So your advice for people wanting to stand out is to talk more about what they do actually outside of work, rather than just their qualifications and experience.
Being proud about who you are, what you believe in.
Yeah.
Be authentic and talk about
passions
and interests.
Yeah, that's really good advice. So we live in a world where we're so connected, and every time I look at my phone, there's notifications from email, social media. So I was wondering how you manage your time as someone who's really busy. Like, in addition to your day job, you invest in so many other companies. You have the record label that we'll get to later. How do you balance all of that? Because there's so much information coming at you. And in your book, you wrote about you said more data will be created this year than in 5,000 years of recorded human history.
Yes.
So.
And that's true every year,
by the way. Yeah, it's true. So, we get so much information thrown at us. So, how do you balance your time, and what advice do you have for people managing their time?
Ancestors were here. So it's a tricky and risky process, which is why they call it the attention on the some circles. I find email to be a pernicious intrusion, frankly, and it probably seems I like coming from a Google guy where Gmail is one of our celebrated products, but I think it's, it's like any tool. If it's misused or used poorly, it can be a pretty dangerous instrument. And I think that's good. Bruce Daisley, who's the VP of Twitter in the year, great book called The Joy of Work, talks about this very eloquently, as well as other parts of our modern work environment. So I have a few techniques. As it relates to email, which is still the sort of primary forms of communication, I batch process. So today, for example, I didn't look at my email all day, and I sat about half an hour before you arrived and I turned my off. So that was it. You could easily sit at the desk.
Yeah.
This is good, most professionals. And then all you do is answer emails all day, and you do it brilliantly. So you're incredibly busy and completely unproductive. So that's one technique. Another technique is block time in my diary just to click or to read. So yesterday I blocked a bunch of time, I disappeared off to a quiet area in the building, and I read a piece of research that had come out recently, so I felt it was really interesting about some technology trends, and that's my time to get to my concentration. So maintaining that time and making sure that it's scheduled and blocked. Try to prioritize really ruthlessly. So I have a three post-it system. I have three post-its in front of me at all times at my desk with WOT, not WFT, WOT, what one thing. And I write down what one thing who I need to achieve this month, this week, and today, in order to call this a success. Amongst the 50 things that are probably on the to-do list, and that just helps you crystallize your clarity.
And if you don't achieve that particular target, do you move it towards another month, or how does that work?
Yeah, well, I mean, if it's right on the list for sure, but assuming it's still important, cross it off if you're passing time. But that sort of helps me, I must see if any to-dos crystallize what really matters.
Yeah.
And I make time outside of work and during the weekend, first and foremost for my family.
Yeah, so let's talk about some of them. So you started this record label to give young artists an opportunity to enter the music space. So how did that come about, and how's it going so far?
Yeah, so initially, like most people, I love music.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's important. So for the awards this week, it was an amazing show.
That's Stormzy.
Stormzy, yeah. Well, Stormzy. So let's start with Stormzy. I mean, Stormzy's example is about answering your question. So Stormzy's really name is Michael.
Yeah.
And Michael grew up in Croydon, mm-hmm. in a pretty poor area, in a council estate, small flat, lots of siblings, not much access to the sort of education that perhaps you and I have enjoyed.
Yeah.
Pretty difficult area in many ways. Lots of barriers, I think, in terms of finding opportunity and access to things that perhaps those of us who have grown up in more privileged environments don't understand or have experience. But what Stormzy was very good at was writing stories. And he started vocalizing those stories, a poet of sorts.
Yeah.
And then he started found a youth centre down the road, and he started recording audience production mates, and eventually proceeded with a few friends in South London Park and got another friend to do filming, I think, on a smartphone or very simple. And he uploaded this. There was a track called Shut Up.
Yeah.
He uploaded it to YouTube. That track now, I think, has about 100 million views. And Stormzy's one of the best recording artists in the world. And what a wonderful example of the democratization of platform technology, because people, no matter where they're from, who they are, where they come from, an opportunity to express themselves in a meaningful and valuable way and make it. That simply wasn't available. Stormzy's story would not have been available even 10 years ago, maybe certainly 20 years ago.
Because you would have to know someone.
You would have to know the lobbies in the industry and get connected and maybe have some other on the way and some resources to start. It's much easier these days. The story that led me into music, sort of somewhat related, is that I started to ask myself, actually in the wake of the referendum in 2016, what am I going to do personally to help people who don't or haven't had the privilege that I have make their mark? How can I give somebody the oxygen to breathe?
Yeah.
So that's where I was coming from. And you know, I started mentoring this young chap from Mitchell. His name's Rosie Court. Watch for that name.
Yeah.
And he was absolutely brilliant, I thought. Very similar backgrounds as Swimsies.
How did you find him? So I want to ask you a hypothetical question. So if it was many years from now and it's the last day for you and the books that you've written, like all the LinkedIn posts, all the videos that you've made are for whatever reason erased, and you can write down three truths from your from everything you know about life, business or whatever it may be, three things that you would leave to the world of your biggest lessons, what would those three things be?
That's an interesting way of phrasing that question. I think the first would be the true measure of wealth and the richness of your life is measured by the impact you have on others. So first and foremost, your family.
Yeah.
If you're lucky enough to have kids or kids. But beyond that, the measure of your success, I think, is the degree to which you can lift others. Because we're communal animals,
yeah.
Our sapiens, we live in cities and collectives and look to contribute. So that would be thing number one. Thing number two, which is more on a personal level, is you're going to be happy and fulfilled all your life, if you really, really understand what science is, your passion, then you keep on doing that. And that will pass through many lots, many jobs, functions, companies, pursuits.
Yeah. So don't always go for the name or the pursuit.
Definitely not. Never take a job for the name, the logo, the title, the salary, or anything. These are trivial external factors. None of them matter.
Yeah.
And it certainly won't make you better. Do what you love and don't settle for this. And then the third thing is, you know, we're here for such a short period of time. We can move humanity forward by staying curious. Because it's the curious people in this world that ask the questions, that find a way, a different way of doing things that move the world on in meaningful ways. And that's going to be personally exciting and leave a mark on the world that's
That's amazing. So, since we're short on time, I'm just going to do a quick fire, if that's okay with you.
Yeah.
The rules are basically you just need to give your gut response, the first thing that comes to your mind, and if you don't like the question, you can pause.
Okay.
So, what are 1, 2, 3 books that have greatly influenced your life?
I'll give you one, Mad Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl.
Yeah.
It's a pretty sexist title, but if you move past that, it's an incredible story of a guy and his wife who were in a concentration camp during the Second World War, and he developed this technique of coping with that, which suddenly became a treatment called logotherapy.
Yeah. Any more books?
Any more books about that? Like this mean one, The Voracious River. This is going to hurt is a very funny rendition of what's interesting and different about the education about the health system.
Yeah.
I've written by another doctor who reflects on that experience. And What Skills Could Be by a guy called Ted Dinsison, who spends a year traveling through 50 states in the US highlighting the bravery of innovative teachers in X one countries. Who are doing amazing things to ignite the best
of
people
and the system. And if you could have a gigantic billboard anywhere with anything on it, metaphorically speaking, getting a message out to millions of people, what would it say and why? It could be a quote even, someone else's quote.
Follow your passion.
Follow your passion. 3 words. Cool. When you feel overwhelmed or unfocused or have lost your focus temporarily, what do you do?
Sleep.
Sleep.
We have sleep loss and
ability.
Last week, I think I went to sleep at 2 minutes late.
Oh, wow.
I get tired and I have more than meetings that I have.
Yeah, and there's a really good book actually called Why We Sleep. Exactly. And it talks about the importance of sleep. And I think it's so underrated in many ways, because especially for there's a lot of people that like are extremely successful, and you get that idea that if you want to be like that, you need to sort of wake up at 5 a.m. every day and like deprive yourself of sleep.
Yeah, so Elon Musk is famous for talking about people who are successful realize they work hard, and having that absolute constant, totally agree with this quote, and we're at our best as people who were working in much to our best of concentration. There's no longer than 7.5 hours a day, and you need 7 to 8 hours of sleep a night, every night.
Yeah.
This is the we're doing on a podcast, but I'm working on that one on quite my right hand and my left.
Yeah, I've heard of it, yeah.
It measures sleep, it's really cool.
And if hypothetically, if you are having a dinner party and can invite 3 people, dead or alive, who do you invite and why?
Richard Pedra.
Yeah.
I talked about him earlier. I think he just sounds like a really fun guy who's full of the zest of life and a real sort of passion, a curious person. Nelson Mandela, would love to be in the aura to a man who turned the nation and really left a mark on the world.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm a huge fan of what this I'm a huge fan of Jacinda Ardern, who's the current New Zealand Prime Minister.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
She's a young leader, certainly younger than me, who has opened a very interesting take and modern take upon the world. And I think she's wonderful. I've had the great fortune of meeting her last time, so she's super kind.
Cool. And last question is, what are you most grateful for?
Grateful for having the life that I have. I'm very, very conscious that I have a comfort and a set of privileges that many people in this life don't. So
yeah.
I'm very grateful for that, very sensitive. I have my health and I have my family.
Good. I think we're going to leave it there. It's been great. I think people can take away so much from this interview, and thank you so much for doing it.
My pleasure.
Yeah. Thank you. Thanks so much.